Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. The facts in this case, which is pending before you, are pretty straightforward, not really in dispute, with the exception of one of two. But essentially, the appellant who we represent was convicted in June 1st, 1994, even though there's some confusion, because if you look at the documents, it looks like he actually entered the guilty plea on May 26th, but that really doesn't affect it. But he essentially was found guilty in the state of Virginia on one count of aggravated sexual battery. And again, it's undisputed, at least for the facts of this case, that that charge is the legal equivalent in this state of unlawful sexual conduct. Second, in 2002, the appellant moved to the state of Delaware with his wife. Beginning in November of 2002, he began to register with the Delaware State Police every year, and that was the case. There were no notification to the community concerning him. He just registered every year with the Delaware State Police.
Did he register when he wasn't legally obligated to do so?
I believe so. He moved to Delaware, in my understanding, as soon as he moved to Delaware, he immediately registered.
And he moved to Delaware when?
In 2002.
But is it also your understanding that when he did register for the first time in Delaware, he wasn't obligated to do so?
That's a good question. He felt he was under the obligation, at least someone from the authority.
I don't care what he felt.
Yeah.
Therapists can deal with feelings.
Correct.
What I want to know is, was he legally obligated to register?
I don't believe so, as the law was written in, from the original law of 1994, because they didn't consider him a sex offender because he was before the June 27, 1994.
Is that significant to the outcome of this case?
I think it initially it was for the time when he was registering on his own. However, the fact that the legislature came back and made it retroactive probably, I guess, rectified that problem that he was doing it on his own at that point. Because when the statute was rectified or changed where there was no time limit, then I think that cured that problem.
So you're suggesting that retroactively the legislature made it a legal requirement for him to register when he did, even though at the time he registered initially, he was under no legal obligation to do so.
That's
your position?
That's my position, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect what prompted the motion in this case?
I looked at that, and I didn't see it from the record below. Again, we did not represent the appellant below. John Sandy did, and I didn't specifically ever ask him that question, so I have to be candid with the court. I don't know the answer to that question. I just know from the entire record that I looked at, it came up on a motion, so it may be a better question for the state. So in August of 2009, the state filed a motion with the Superior Court in Sussex County to have him declared a sex offender pursuant to 4121 and to have him assessed as a Tier 2 sex offender. Of course, Mr. Sandy filed written objections to that, basically suggesting to the court that the section that should have applied to the appellant was Section 4122, in which the state, and it had been the normal practice for the state to actually make the designation, and then pursuant to that section, that individual could then request a hearing before the Board of Parole.
Now, doesn't this all turn in part on the in-state, out-of-state conviction distinction?
I believe so, yes, absolutely. That's what it comes down to, because I believe it's the state's position that for out-of-state defendants, from reading the position, it doesn't matter when they were convicted. It's always going to be determined by the court. However, it's our position that they individuals moving into the state should be treated like individuals who had their convictions in the state, and that any convictions prior to 1994 should be treated pursuant to Section 4122, which is not how this case took place.
Well, the state argues that it's logical if you're convicted in state to where you start with the court to then go to the board. but that for out-of-state people, it's logical to start with the court also. Why doesn't that make sense, that everybody should start with the court?
Well, because I think the statutory section set up that the way it's set up is that prior to 1994, according to the initial Megan's Law, as it's been called, that they were not sex offenders, and that they've always interpreted Section 4122 that they should treat in-state people by going through that section. To me, it's not logical to treat in-state, out-state, out-of-state people differently when the results can still be treated the same way by going through 4122 for anything prior to 1994 and then anything after that. Of course, in Delaware, anything now is automatically going to go through the court, but anything prior to 1994 could go through the normal process as they are treating state of Delaware residents when they were convicted. Our position is that essentially you have to look at the entire history of 4121, 4122 to come to that conclusion when interpreting those two sections. It's been our position that initially when 4121N, which is the applicable section in this case, became effective in January of 2008, sex offenders, people convicted prior to June 27, 1994, were not considered sex offenders. Megan's Law actually came into effect in June 27, 1994. In fact, from its inception to was amended until July of 2008, the definition of sex offender did not include individuals convicted prior to 1994. It's our position that if you read those two sections together and take into this history, that it appears that the legislature intended to create this separate retroactive system for people convicted prior to 1994, because it is a totally separate system or a way to handle the issues. And to treat out-of-state convicted defendants differently, I did not see in the written response what the logical reason would be to treat them any differently, like it would be difficult to assess them or, you know, the court would have better records how to deal with it. That's not the case. The appellant's position is when you take his into the entire history of how the statutes change from when they decided to make it totally retroactive, which there is no cut off at 1994 or whatever the case may be, when you take all that into consideration, that it seems more logical to treat everyone who was convicted prior to June 27, 1994 under Section 4122. Superior Court disagreed with that argument, and that same argument was submitted below by Mr. Sandy. It was
What's your position with respect to today? Forget that your client committed this in early June, late May of, you know, the prior year. If someone came in from out of state today with an out of state conviction 3 years ago, where would they go?
It appears from what I'm suggesting to the court is that the state would, in that situation where it's only 3 years ago, the state would file a motion with the court to determine what tier designation they should set.
So then we're coming down to this focus on retroactivity and the date of the crime. If we agree today for a relatively recent out-of-state conviction, an out-of-state person would start with the Superior Court. Your client is saying, notwithstanding the fact that we've eliminated all dates for all purposes, that somehow this June 27, 1994 date is still relevant to your client, notwithstanding the legislature's effort to eliminate it.
Correct.
Okay.
And the one reason why I say that, because if you look in sections 4122 and 4121, specifically 4121S, of that section, where it specifically notes subject, and this is 4121N, subject to 4122 of this title, this section shall apply to all persons convicted. And then if you look at 4122A, it essentially says the same. Section 4121 of this title shall be retroactively applicable to any person convicted of a registering offense. So I still think that, based upon our argument, that realistically we can make the argument that 4122 should have applied to our client because his conviction was prior to the June 27, 1994 date. And then that's even in the state agrees that in-state individuals convicted prior to then should go through that section.
Well, you put the rabbit in the hat, though, when you said in-state individuals should go through that because the state disagrees with your position when it comes to out-of-state, don't they?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that question, Your Honor. I apologize.
I think the state is still trying to maintain a distinction between in-state and out-of-state.
Absolutely, they are.
Now,
I agree.
The state relies on the synopsis in the legislation for the proposition that people didn't have to register before we had Megan's Law because, by definition, nobody had to register. And that what the subsequent amendments were really trying to make clear is, even if you were convicted prior to Megan's Law, you had to register.
Yes.
So that would encompass your client.
Yes. My client does not dispute that he should have to register as it is written. He doesn't dispute that.
He would just like to start with the board and not the court.
Because there is an entirely different process that takes place, and there's been a history where the board seems to be exercising discretion, rather where the court seems to be mandated to follow 4121N. So,
and at the end of the day, for your client, that's the important issue.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I can't
being able to argue to the Board of Parole that they should exercise discretion in his case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's our position, and that was the position below, that should have been the process that should have been taking place because he wanted to have an opportunity to try to convince some board tribunal that he did not have to be designated a Tier 2.
First, I guess I should say, if my facts are correct, is there any significance that when he first registered there was no tier designation? Does that have any significance on the outcome of this case at all? Assuming I'm factually correct that there was a blank line where the AG's office was to fill in the tier designation, but that never happened. Whatever reason it didn't happen, maybe it was because there was no requirement he registered, maybe it's because administratively it was behind the radiator. Who knows? Who cares? Does it make any difference at the end of the day?
I don't think it makes a difference at the end of the day. He registered as he thought he had to do.
But when was his initial tier designation by anyone?
The initial tier designation would have been by the court. I know Mr. Saney had argued below that essentially he was being treated as a Tier 1 designee due to the fact that the only thing from 2002 to 2008 was that he was registering, but there was no notification to the community, which is normally required of a Tier 2 and a Tier 3. That never transpired. So I think that's why the argument was made below, and I made that argument here, that even though it was still being, he was being up the level from what he was at previously.
Before I slip fatally into the quicksand of, all of the changes that have been made to the statutory language, let me just ask you flat out, what are the precise issues that we need to decide? For example, if you look at Section 4122 in isolation from everything else, it gets you to where you want to go if you're client's situation involves a redesignation. Are you claiming that what is involved here is a redesignation for purposes of 4122 or not?
The way the statute reads is the Attorney General makes the designation, and then
now
when
just
they
tell me whether that is an issue that we have to decide. If you're not claiming that it's a redesignation, it's not an issue, then I'm going to ask you, what is the issue?
I don't think the term redesignation or designation is a big fact in this case. I think the statute allows someone to designate what level he should be at.
Are you relying on 4122 at all?
Absolutely.
Then if 4122 applies, then this case has to involve a redesignation.
Correct.
And we have to find that.
I think the reason Justice Jacob asked that question, and I put myself at risk by assuming I know the reason, but based on what you said earlier, I took it to be there was a de facto Tier 1 designation because that's the way he was treated from the time he registered. And in order to move from de facto Tier 1 to Tier 2, that constitutes a redesignation?
I agree with that, that the way that's put, that essentially he was treated from 2002 to 2008 as a Tier 1 offender, and that whoever made the next step of whether the court, the AG's office, whatever, they were going to make a change in him, so that would be a redesignation.
Even though he was never formally designated as Tier 1, your position is de facto default position, he was treated as Tier 1.
Absolutely, because for almost 6 years he did that, and he was required to go into the Delaware State Police and do that.
Okay, did you want to save the balance of your time? You have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. I don't know that I can disagree that redesignation isn't a huge matter. I think it's an incredibly huge matter because 4122 speaks always in terms of redesignation. And it makes sense because what that means is he's already been designated by a court. And now because of some change in the law, and there have been, as Your Honor pointed out, many changes in this law, tiers have changed. And so what it allows is for the Attorney General not to have to go back to court, but to change that designation. And in 4122.
Well, before you go on, just to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, assuming, you know, with that you're having to concede, that there was a de facto designation of this defendant under Tier 1, your argument is that that's not good enough. There has to be a formal designation before there can be a redesignation. And since there was never a formal designation, for whatever reason, 4122 doesn't capture this case. Is that your position?
Yes, that is the state's. That's the state's initial position, and the reason for that, I believe, the reason that there was never any formal designation is that 4122 prior, when in 1998, when 4122 came into existence, it only allowed for tiering of people after 1996. There was always this evolution of Megan's Law. Nobody quite knew what the retroactivity aspects of it would be. In fact, that's why at first it looked only forward from 1994 on. Then when Smith versus Doe was decided, when this court decided Hellman, it became clearer to everyone that, in fact, because of the nature of what Megan's Law was, non-punitive, it was a public safety statute, that retroactivity could be applied. That's why, in fact, in 2008, both the federal system and the state system said, it's fully applicable to people who have sex offenses on their record and therefore will be registered in certain ways. One of those interim steps was in 1998 when the tier designations, the three risk assessment tiers, were first enacted. And they only went back to 1996. That would not have captured Mr. Tenbush. And in fact, until 2008's changes, he would have never been captured or had to have been tiered in any way necessarily. That's why he was, so what we had on our registry were people who were just non-tiered, period. The state suggests respectfully, though, that it does make quite a bit of difference as to whether or not this is redesignation or not. If it's not redesignation, we just go to 4121N, and the court did exactly what it needed to do.
So what prompted the motion in this case? Was it the amendment to the law where the state just went to the state police and said, how many people do you have that don't have a tier designation, and then you filed motions with respect to everybody?
That's precisely what was going on, Your Honor. In 2008, when we had all these folks from prior to 1996 who had no tiers, we had to file a motion. That was our only way to do that. Now, redesignation, when somebody already has a tier and there's been some change in the law that maybe a crime was bumped from Tier 1 to Tier 2.
Then you can go to the parole board, right?
Well, the state can first sends a letter to the offender saying, look, because of the law change, you are now Tier 2, and they can go to the Board of Parole. One of the interesting issues in this, and one of the reasons that Mr. Tenbush wants to get himself into 422 is this fallacy that the Board of Parole can do something that the court cannot. And I say that's a fallacy because it's a whole total misreading of 4122. If you read 4122, it starts with the Attorney General under 4122B and says they shall apply 4121 of this title. And they shall redesignate the persons to a risk assessment tier pursuant to 4121. In other words, we go to 4121D, we say, what's your crime? There's where you are. The review that they get is that the Board of Parole then determines, quote, shall hold a hearing to determine the appropriateness of the AG's new risk assessment tier designation. There's no discretion in that. Appropriateness means, is it appropriate under the law?
So you're saying whatever is driving this dispute isn't real?
Yes.
But does that matter for purposes of this case? I mean, do we have to address that?
Only if the court goes to the equal protection question and says this is actually a redesignation and the person would get some better benefit out of the Board of Parole. I can tell the court this. Gosh, would it clarify a lot of things for a lot of people, because we do know. And the reason the state wrote it in its brief, if you notice, there's no citation, because we can't get that issue in front of a court. Well, there's no appeal from the Board of Parole, either from the state or the defense. And we've been trying to figure out how to cabin the Board of Parole into the very statutory scheme that says you go by offense. Appropriateness doesn't mean, do you think it's right for this guy to get a certain designation? Appropriateness means the law.
We could take it the next step, too, and say we all see on the horizon where the Board of Parole is going to disappear. So there's another reason why you could argue, I suspect, that this is how many angels are dancing on the head of the pin ultimately, because there is a looming dead end at the end of the road. But that said, if it's correct that it is Board of Parole that reviews, the time and place to determine whether that's a stymie for Tenbush is when he's before the Board of Parole, isn't it? That's an argument you make to them about they do or do not have the authority to appropriately designate or review the appropriateness of the AG's designation.
Look, obviously, Your Honor, the legal process needs to be followed, and if this is a redesignation, it does need to go first. The AG does need to make it. I'm not saying we can violate the law and just say he would have gotten the same result either way, so it doesn't much matter the process.
I think that we're going to have enough difficulty with the issues that are before us.
Well, except that our concern is this, Your Honor. Because he does claim equal protection, and his claim is part of the reason that this statutory scheme doesn't make sense or would be unconstitutional is I get a better result out of the Board of Parole than I get out of the court.
And but if the court equal protection argument wasn't raised below, no. So it's a Rule 8 plain error issue for us to consider if we wish in the interest of justice. But
yes.
It's not something we'll necessarily reach.
That's true, Your Honor. But I think that what the court can do is affirm what the Superior Court said, and that is there is no statutory authority and there's no support in the law, and the court, Superior Court said this, to believe that the Board of Parole has an ability that the court does not.
Well, it maybe I misread the briefs, but isn't there a suggestion that the Board of Parole has, in fact, in the past, interpreted the appropriateness of the AG's tier designation and then modified it? Did I misread the briefs?
No, they have done that. We believe that that's...
And your position is they've done it, but they've had no authority to do it.
Exactly.
And because there's no review of what they do, it's sort of a lost in space kind of
That's exactly the problem. If you funnel these folks to the Board of Parole, we can do nothing about it. And the problem...
But on a redesignation, they are funneled to the Board of Parole to the extent that the statute says after the AG makes its designation, you can go to the board for review. Is that correct?
Yes.
But you seem to be saying it has no authority to do anything. Whatever the AG's designation is it. So what's the purpose of going to the board if the board can never review your designation?
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry if I misspoke about where the levels of review are. Absolutely, the Board of Parole can review it, and it reviews it for appropriateness, appropriateness under 4121. Did the state get it right? For instance, if the guy was convicted of unlawful sexual contact second degree and the state gave him a Tier 3 designation, obviously the Board of Parole can change that to ensure that it is correct under the law. It wants to give folks who are going to get redesignated the ability to get some review so that it's not
just
a second
degree. That's basically a ministerial role.
Excuse me?
That's basically a ministerial role.
I don't know that it's ministerial, right? Necessarily. Right?
Well, I mean, it's not equitable. It's not discretionary.
Right.
I mean, suppose the AG's designation is correct under the law, but the board doesn't like it. It thinks it's too harsh. Your position is the board has no discretion to change that.
Exactly.
But it is doing that. It has done that before.
But I can tell you anecdotally, yes,
okay.
They have done it. And it's troubling to the state because...
Well, it's an only in Delaware moment for all of us, isn't it? Because isn't the Board of Parole represented by and advised by a member of the Attorney General's office?
Yes. And
I love this state.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, the conversations we have had within our office are not ones I could share with the court.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, are you the right hand or the left?
I can tell you that the advice that has been given to the Board of Parole has been consistent, but that doesn't mean that they're going to follow it.
Maybe they've been reading too much about judicial independence.
the Board of Parole's real role then ends up being the same as the courts. I mean, courts, the Superior Court, when it has to register somebody as a sex offender, is bound to, by 4121D, to say, this is the crime, this is where you go.
I think we understand your position. Whether or not it's properly before us is something we're going to have to decide. But what I am trying to still find out is what is properly before us. Let's assume that we agree with you 100% in your position that you can't have a redesignation under 4122 before you have a designation, and designation means formal designation, and since there hasn't been any, there's no relief under 4122. My question is, does that dispose of this appeal, or is there another issue that we have to confront?
I suggest that actually that would dispose of this appeal, because then clearly 4121N and D apply to Mr. Tenbush. If there is a redesignation, if in fact there is a redesignation, and he would have to go below, it still leaves open the very question as to what the Board of Parole would do.
Can I go back to the question I asked Mr. Morris, which is there any significance to the fact when Mr. Tenbush registered, even under circumstances that would suggest he wasn't required to do so, and there was a line for a designation and the blank remained, it wasn't filled in by the AG's office, is there anything significant about that?
I believe that makes it clear that he was never designated.
But the line was there for some reason. Wasn't the AG supposed to make a designation?
No. In 2002, Your Honor, the only folks designated were those after 1996. That was by operation of 4122A, I believe, or 4122B, which said that's in 1998 when 4122 came into existence. It said that those convicted after June 21st of 1996, before March 1 of 1999, because that's when it became effective.
Was there no line for a tier designation on the form that was filled out?
There was. It was a 2002 form. And so the reality is that you have a bunch of people who are coming into the system who are tiered. They're at post-1996. But you also have folks who are coming into the system and are registered but not designated by law yet. And the reason they're not designated was the law did not apply tier designation to those past 1996.
Somebody looked at all of this. We'll just assume someone looked at what was going on. What we would see in 2002 is that you had a 1994 conviction from out of state being registered. Since it preceded 1996, there was no ability to make a designation.
Yes.
Then the law changed later to eliminate all the dates. So if you were ever convicted of a crime, you would get designated. And then the state started filing motions for all of the undesignated people to designate them for the first time.
Yes, sir. That's precisely what happened. And the reason to answer the Chief Justice's question, the reason in 2002 the line wasn't filled out, he was pre-1996. So by law, we could not designate him or put him on a tier. He was just a non-tiered registered sex offender. And we had quite a group of them. That's who we're cleaning up with these types of motions.
Do you agree that he was treated as if he were tier one from that point forward?
Yes, because basically tier two and tier three get community notification and all those types of things. There was nothing else to treat him as. So they basically treated them as the lowest level tiered person.
But that seems to be where everyone was lumped pre-1996 until the change in the law.
Yes, if you were untiered, you would be, quote, treated as a
tier one. So if you were a 1994 out-of-state conviction that everyone would agree was tier two or three, you still wouldn't have been designated anything because it preceded 1996.
Yes, Your Honor. You would only be registered as a sex offender and treated as a tier one, but you had no designations because that's what the 1998 law said. You could not tier people prior to 1996. Just to answer the one brief question about whether he had to register at all, that's a very interesting question. He was convicted June 1st of 1994. He was sentenced July 26, 1994, after our Megan's Law came into. So then the whole question is, who's convicted, and does a conviction not occur until sentencing? Well, the reality was he was registered. Right,
I don't know,
so
whether,
have to worry about that.
We don't know what the Commonwealth of Virginia's answer may be to that, but we do know in Delaware you're not convicted until sentencing, right?
Right.
No finality, and then the appeal time runs.
And that makes sense also because that's when we actually do register folks, is at sentencing. So that's when his registration responsibility would have come, and that would have been after Megan's Law. So when he came in 2002, he properly registered, there's no doubt. By operation of law, he just wasn't designated yet, and therefore, in 2008, he wasn't, quote, redesignated. He was designated for the first time by the Superior Court by operation of 4121N. And unless the Court has any further questions.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Couple statements. When I was coming over here today, my partner, one of the questions I asked him, because I knew it was going to probably come up, is about the border parole and how should I respond, and his initial response is, well, the AG's office has someone there representing the board, yet they're taking the other position. Clearly, you know, they're getting advice what to do, and, you know, so in the Chief Justice question was essentially the same question, so I find that ironic. The state's brief indicated that the state has been interpreting Section 4122 as requiring the Attorney General's office to perform the initial tiering of pre-1994 in-state offenders with a right of review by the Board of Parole. That's essentially what my client is asking that happen in his case, that his initial tiering be determined in the same fashion. Again, based upon the arguments we made in the brief, and I'm not going to regurgitate it, and unless the Court has any more questions about that, I'd be more than happy to ask. If the Court doesn't accept our position about the statutory interpretation, we did raise the equal protection issue. It was not raised below. Quite frankly, I found that case the day before I filed my opening brief, just to be candid with the Court. But I do think that does create an issue, which is relevant to this question. So unless the Court has any more questions.
Well, do you think it creates an issue that in the interest of justice we should take it up despite the fact it wasn't addressed?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think it's an important fact. I think the Doe decision it made an important finding that if you're treating in-state and out-of-state people different when designating them, whether there has to be a notification to the community. In that situation, Your Honor, if you probably already know, Doe involved where out-of-state defendants, whether they were propensity to violence or recommit because of some mental health issue, was not an issue at all. There was a notification requirement. With in-state defendants in the state of Pennsylvania, there actually had to be a civil hearing before that took place. So the court in Doe felt that out-of-state defendants were not getting a similar situated opportunity to contest notification. And that's, as it exists right now, and the state acknowledges, there is a different system in place before the Board of Parole than it is for the court. The court, according to the language of N, it says shall. So the court has been interpreting that, you know, they fall within the crime. That's the tier they get. The Board of Parole, because there has been a history of it being a discretionary board, in fact, there's been numerous cases decided that normally the Board of Parole has discretion, that's how they've been interpreting it. And quite frankly, if you look at Section 4122, there's no language in that section like 4121N where it has they shall be designated pursuant to 4121D. It does not have that language. It says the Board of Parole can have or there can be a hearing before the Board of Parole and does not provide any further guidance or any mandatory language that has to fall within 4121D. So that would be our argument that the board would have that ability to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Thank you.